Thank you for letting me present today. I'm going to be talking to you about screening for special healthcare needs, a descriptive analysis of preschool and healthcare provider practices in low-income neighborhoods. Through that. First, I'd like to start with a little background information about the group that I work for and what led to this research. My organization is called Applied Survey Research, and we are a nonprofit social research firm working in the Greater Bay Area of California. We have two offices, one in Santa Cruz, in the Santa Cruz area, and one in San Jose, California. Our research is community-based. We work with local nonprofits, government agencies, and private foundations conduct research to help people build better communities, and much of our work is focused on serving vulnerable populations. Now, over the years, one of our key research projects at ASR has been measuring school readiness levels of children as they enter kindergarten. In Santa Clara County, our firm has been conducting countywide measurements of school readiness levels of incoming kindergarten students every 1 to 2 years since 2004. As part of that work, we have developed a brief but valid and reliable instrument in which teachers are measuring the readiness levels of incoming kindergarten students using a whole child perspective. You know, the sort of self-care and motor skills, social-emotional skills, and then also the more traditional kindergarten academic types of skills as well. So as part of that work, we collect data about children's identification as having special needs. And in the years of collecting this information, we've found somewhat lower rates of identified special needs in our incoming kindergarten students than we would have expected for this population. And since early identification and receiving services for students is strongly linked to their ability to succeed in school, we were interested in learning more about, you know, if and where there were breakdowns happening in screening processes for children up until the point that they're coming into kindergarten. So before I get too far into describing the studies that we conducted, I'd like to set the context a little bit for what it is to work in Santa Clara County. By most of the broad brushstroke measures, Santa Clara County is a great place to be. It enjoys a high median income for our children. Preschool attendance rates are very high relative to most other counties in California, and they're still increasing as well. There's a wonderful amount of diversity in the county. I think based on 2000 census data, Santa Clara County ranks, I think, as number 4 nationwide on the diversity index. But there's also a lot of need in the county as well. When you scratch the surface of those kind of broad brushstroke descriptions, you find, for example, that median household income for Hispanic and Latino families is nearly half of, for example, Asian families in the county. And the great preschool attendance rates are wonderful, but you also find extreme variability in the quality of those preschool experiences. And of course, the diversity of the county is a wonderful thing as well, but we have 22% of county residents who report that they speak English less than very well, and this can be a challenge for delivery of services that are still largely English language based. So in the midst of this well-off and well-resourced county, there is great need as well. And our task for our purposes in this study was to find regions of the county that had particularly high need populations and to look more closely at the screening-related attitudes and practices of the providers that serve families in those regions. First, I'll talk a little bit about a survey that we did of early care and education providers. For this study, we received names, addresses, and telephone numbers of all licensed child care centers and family child care homes in the county. We looked at the zip codes of those sites, and we included, for our study purposes, sites that were in the same zip code as a low-performing elementary school, sites with zip codes where there were large proportions of low-income residents, and sites in zip codes where there were large gaps between the available and the needed subsidized childcare slots. We were also somewhat purposeful in removing from our sample any sites that we could in advance identify as being part of a larger network that had a lot of established procedures and practices, because what we really wanted to do was we wanted to find sites that may be most in need of intervention, determine the extent to which they had practices that could be improved, and look more closely at how we could best do that. So we conducted telephone surveys in spring of 2009 with 45 childcare providers. The people we talked to were site supervisors and center directors for the most part, 34 family childcare providers, and 7 provider types that were unidentified. By their self-report, they indicated that they served approximately 5,600 children in the county. So first, we asked, I should say that this was part of a larger survey. We were trying to accomplish many goals in the context of a single survey. So there is always opportunity for more to explore with this, but this was a first pass look at what we could figure out about provider screening practices. So providers were first asked to indicate which of 3 statements reflected their practices when it came to monitoring the developmental progress of the children in their care. Now they could choose 0, 1, 2, or 3 of these approaches. We started with, we use our best judgment based on our experience and training. They could say yes or no to this. We have a screening tool that we use when we have concerns about a child. Again, yes or no. Or we give every child a formal developmental screening on site. So as I present the results to you, I'm actually going to present them in the reverse of how we asked them, just for the sake of ease of presentation here. As this chart indicates, when asked whether they were or were not giving every child a formal developmental screening on site, when you look at this with all providers together, 44% of providers were conducting screenings with every child in their care. However, when you look at the comparison of center-based providers versus family care providers, you could see that center-based providers were doing this at nearly twice the rate of family child care providers. Just over half of center-based providers were giving every child a formal developmental screening, and 29% of family child care providers were doing this. And on practices related to use of a screening tool when providers had concerns about a child, we see that these rates were very similar for center-based and family child care providers, with 42% of center-based and 38% of family child care providers using a screening tool when they saw something that indicated a concern. Now for this next slide, I'm going to present results to you a little bit differently for the sake of time. We were really interested in looking at the percentage of providers who indicated that the only strategy that they were using. So remember that in those previous slides, they could have indicated multiple strategies, multiple practices. But for this one, I'm going to present to you the percentage of providers who were only using their experience and training, their best judgment, when it came to determining whether or not there was something that they felt was a concern that required follow-up. So our center-based providers indicated, 27% of our center-based providers indicated that when it came to monitoring the developmental progress of their students or the children in their care, that 27% of them were using only this method. For family child care providers, it was half of the providers who were using only this method. And then all providers together was 36%. We also asked these providers to tell us a little bit about the barriers that they perceived when it came to identifying special needs or developmental delays. And we provided a list of 4 possible barriers, as well as an opportunity to indicate others. And they responded yes or no to the following: parent resistance to hearing about concerns, financial or healthcare coverage issues among the family members that they serve, the availability of local resources for follow-up, and staff training to identify and address possible needs or delays. And our findings indicated that the biggest barrier that providers perceived was parents being resistant to hearing information that there may be a possible delay or concern in their child. This was followed by a large number of providers indicating that parents of the children they served had financial or healthcare coverage issues that might interfere with following up. And then just under half of providers indicated two other barriers: that the availability of local resources was a problem, and that staff training to conduct these screenings was a barrier. So these results were generally the center-based providers perceived more barriers than the family child care providers, which is not surprising because they're also conducting screenings at a higher rate, so they have more opportunity to perceive barriers as such. So, and the staff training issue, more experience with formal screening was also significantly related to believing that staff training was an issue for them. So, to summarize the study, many providers in these high-need regions are not screening children with any consistent practices or standardized tools, especially providers in the family child care homes that we sampled, and high percentages of providers perceive barriers, particularly with parent resistance in, you know, the effective identification and follow-up for possible special needs and developmental delays. Of course, one of the things that we were interested when we looked at the findings related to parent resistance was we wanted to know more about whether this is providers' anxiety about how parents will receive this information, or whether it was actually parents pushing back when this topic has been broached. And it wasn't something that we could tease out from the information that we collected, but we did believe that in either case, the perception can create sort of a barrier to open dialogue with parents. So keeping these in mind as I very briefly talk about the second study in this set, we also, just this past spring, did a survey of pediatric healthcare providers in the county. It was a survey, again, with multiple purposes in mind, and we had a larger sample than what I'm going to talk about today. But for this group, we included the subset of healthcare providers who reported that one half or more of their patients have financial or health insurance difficulties that affect their healthcare decisions. And many of the zip codes that were represented in this study overlapped with the ECE provider survey that I just described. And most of the respondents were pediatricians, MDs. So, as this slide shows, one of the set of questions that we asked providers about, these again are healthcare providers, was we asked them to indicate whether whether a list of potential barriers was not an issue, a small issue, or a big issue for them in effectively identifying and addressing special needs or developmental delays. This slide shows the top four reasons that were indicated as being a big issue according to these healthcare providers. So you can see that number one on the list is time. Not surprisingly, pediatric healthcare providers have so many things they have to cram into a well-child visit that that they sometimes feel that they don't have enough time to thoroughly screen, and this gets in the way. This was followed by two-thirds of providers saying that there are just not enough services for following up on identified special needs or delays, and actually, the write-in comments that we got on this was expressed a great deal of frustration on this particular front, that that there was just really not nearly enough resources to serve the needs of particularly the low-income populations who were on Medi-Cal. And then this was followed by two sort of communication and materials-related issues. The literacy level of parents was indicated as being a big issue by 63% of providers, as well as tools not being available, screening tools not being available in other languages. And the parent resistant piece that we learned more about with the ECE providers, yes, this was something that a similar percentage of healthcare providers indicated was an issue, but for most of them, they indicated that this was a small issue. So pulling data together from the two of these studies shows there's actually some complementarity to the issues that are faced by these two different types of providers in these low-income regions. The asset that the ECE providers have on their side is they have the ongoing relationships with parents. They see them day in and day out, and they certainly have more time and often a better ability to, you know, communicate in an ongoing sense and connect with parents. So with some investment and in outreach and training to our ECE providers in these low-income communities, we can build our skills and confidence in conducting developmental screening and effectively communicating those results to parents. And again, you know, at the very least, we can give them some opportunities to give this information to parents and give parents the option of taking it to their pediatrician who can follow up, you know, if parent resistance to hearing the information is such an issue among the ECE providers, then the likely follow-up that parents can do with pediatricians, you know, the pediatricians tend to have more credibility in these types of issues. And so that sort of one-two push of increased screening, increasing the screening practices among among the ECE providers, you know, that can actually help the pediatricians do their work more effectively as well. But of course, issues with coordination and communication across systems has emerged in both of these groups in some of the other information that we've gathered as being a significant challenge as well. And there is still that big nut to crack in terms of making sure that services are available once children have been identified as having a concern that needs follow-up. So, and these are areas that organizations like First Five in our community are currently working on improving. So thank you for your time, and I'd also like to thank the Santa Clara County Partnership for School Readiness, who provided funding and input for the surveys that I described today. Thank you. Any questions? Yeah. Yeah, so it's
literacy.
Yeah, so it wasn't, I mean, this was a part of a long list of possible barriers that the providers could endorse. So what I can tell you about that from some of the other information in the survey that I didn't get to present, and from some of the write-ins that providers provided, was that they would like to be able to, it comes in two forms. One is parent education materials, and the other is in actually the tools themselves, because in many cases the education materials that they have to inform parents about you know, what to look for and how to monitor their child's developmental progress are written at a higher literacy level than their population might connect with very well. The other issue is that many of these providers would like to do something where they have the parents who are coming in to visit fill something out in the waiting room prior to going into the well-child exam, just to save some time there. But without those tools, one, being at an appropriate literacy level for some of them, and not being in other languages, that capacity is limited. So, thank you. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.